This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents The Eyes of the Dragon by Stephen King. Read by Bronson Pinchot.
This story is for my great friend, Ben Straub, and for my daughter, Naomi King. Once, in a kingdom called Delane, there was a king with two sons. Delane was a very old kingdom, and it had hundreds of kings, perhaps even thousands. When time goes on long enough, not even historians can remember everything. Roland the Good was neither the best nor the worst king ever to rule the land. He tried very hard not to do anyone great evil, and mostly succeeded. He also tried very hard to do great works, but unfortunately he didn't succeed so well at that. The result was a very mediocre king. He doubted if he would be remembered long after he was dead, and his death might come at any time now because he had grown old, and his heart was failing. He had perhaps 1 year left, perhaps three. Everyone who knew him, and everyone who observed his gray face and shaking hands when he held court, agreed that in 5 years at the very most a new king would be crowned in the great plaza at the foot of the Needle, and it would only be 5 years with God's grace. So everyone in the kingdom, from the richest baron and the most foppishly dressed courtier to the poorest serf and his ragged wife, thought and talked about the king-in-waiting, Roland's elder son, Peter. And one man thought and planned and brooded on something else, how to make sure that Roland's younger son, Thomas, should be crowned king instead. This man was Flagg, the king's magician. 2. Although Roland the king was old, he admitted to 70 years but was surely older than that, his sons were young. He had been allowed to marry late because he had met no woman who pleased his fancy, and because his mother, the great Dowager Queen of Delane, had seemed immortal to Roland and to everyone else, and that included her. She had ruled the kingdom for almost 50 years when, one day at tea, she put a freshly cut lemon in her mouth to ease a troublesome cough that had been plaguing her for a week or better. At that particular tea time, a juggler had been performing for the amusement of the Dowager Queen and her court. He was juggling 5 cunningly made crystal balls. Just as the queen put the slice of lemon into her mouth, the juggler dropped one of his glass spheres. It shattered on the tiled floor of the great east courtroom with a loud report. The Dowager Queen gasped at the sound. When she gasped, she pulled the lemon slice down her throat and choked to death very quickly. 4 days later, the coronation of Roland was held in the Plaza of the Needle. The juggler did not see it. He had been beheaded on the executioner's block behind the Needle 3 days before that. A king without heirs makes everybody nervous, especially when the king is 50 and balding. It was thus in Roland's best interest to marry soon and to make an heir soon. His close adviser, Flagg, made Roland very aware of this. He also pointed out that at 50, the years left to him in which he could hope to create a child in a woman's belly were only a few. Flagg advised him to take a wife soon, and never mind waiting for a lady of noble birth who would take his fancy. If such a lady had not come into view by the time a man was 50, Flagg pointed out, she probably never would. Roland saw the wisdom of this and agreed, never knowing that Flagg, with his lank hair and his white face that was almost always hidden behind a hood, understood his deepest secret, that he had never met the woman of his fancy, because he had never really fancied women at all. Women worried him, and he had never fancied the act that puts babies in the bellies of women. That act worried him, too. But he saw the wisdom of the magician's advice, and 6 months after the Dowager Queen's funeral, there was a much happier event in the kingdom, the marriage of King Roland to Sasha, who would become the mother of Peter and Thomas. Roland was neither loved nor hated in Delane. Sasha, however, was loved by all. When she died giving birth to the second son, the kingdom was plunged into darkest mourning that lasted a year and a day. She had been one of 6 women Flagg had suggested to his king as possible brides. Roland had known none of these women, who were all similar in birth and station. They were all of noble blood, but none of royal blood. All were meek and pleasant and quiet. Flagg suggested no one who might take his place as the mouth closest to the king's ear. Roland chose Sasha because she seemed the quietest and meekest of the half-dozen, and the least likely to frighten him. So they were wed. Sasha of the Western Barony, a very small barony indeed, was then 17 years old, 33 years younger than her husband. She had never seen a man with his drawers off before her wedding night. When, on that occasion, she observed his flaccid penis, she asked with great interest, "What's that, husband?" If she had said anything else, or if she had said what she said in a slightly different tone of voice, the events of that night, and this entire history, might have taken another course. In spite of the special drink Flagg had given him an hour before, at the end of the wedding feast, Roland might simply have slunk away. But he saw her then exactly as she was, a very young girl who knew even less about the baby-making act than he did, and observed her mouth was kind and began to love her, as everyone in Delane would grow to love her. "It is King's iron," he said. "It doesn't look like iron," said Sasha doubtfully. "It is before the forge," he said.
"Ah," said she. "And where is the forge?"
"If you will trust me," said he, getting into bed with her, "I will show you, for you have brought it from the Western Barony with you, but did not know it." 3. The people of Delane loved her because she was kind and good. It was Queen Sasha who created the great hospital, Queen Sasha who wept so over the cruelty of the bear-baiting in the plaza that King Roland finally outlawed the practice, Queen Sasha who pleaded for a remission of King's taxes in the year of the great drought, when even the leaves of the great old tree went gray. Did Flagg plot against her, you might ask? Not at first. These were relatively small things in his view, because he was a real magician and had lived hundreds and hundreds of years. He even allowed the remission of taxes to pass, because the year before, Delane's navy had smashed the Anduin pirates who had plagued the kingdom's southern coast for over 100 years. The skull of the Anduin pirate king grinned from a spike outside the palace walls, and Delane's treasury was rich with recovered plunder. In larger matters, matters of state, it was still Flagg's mouth, which was closest to King Roland's ear, and so Flagg was at first content. 4. Although Roland grew to love his wife, he never grew to love that activity which most men consider sweet, the act which produces both the lowliest cook's prentice and the heir to the highest throne. He and Sasha slept in separate bedrooms, and he did not visit her often. These visits would happen no more than 5 or 6 times in a year, and on some of those occasions no iron could be made at the forge, in spite of Flagg's ever more potent drinks and Sasha's unfailing sweetness. But 4 years after the marriage, Peter was made in her bed, and on that one night Roland had no need of Flagg's drink, which was green and foaming and which always made him feel a little strange in his head, as if he had gone crazy. He had been hunting that day in the preserves with 12 of his men. Hunting was the thing that Roland had always loved most of all, the smell of the forest, the crisp tang of the air, the sound of the horn, and the feel of the bow as an arrow left on a true hard course. Gunpowder was known, but rare in Delane, and to hunt game with an iron tube was considered low and contemptible in any case. Sasha was reading in bed when he came to her, his ruddy, bearded face alight, but she laid her book on her bosom and listened raptly to his story as he told it, his hands moving. Near the end, he drew back to show her how he had drawn back the bow and had let Foehammer, his father's great arrow, fly across the little glen. When he did this, she laughed and clapped and won his heart. The king's preserves had almost been hunted out. In these modern days it was rare to find so much as a good-sized deer in them, and no one had seen a dragon since time out of mind. Most men would have laughed if you had suggested there might still be such a mythy creature left in that tame forest. But an hour before sundown on that day, as Roland and his party were about to turn back, that was just what they found. Or what found them. The dragon came crashing and blundering out of the underbrush, its scales glowing a greenish copper color, its soot-caked nostrils venting smoke. It had not been a small dragon either, but a male just before its first molting. Most of the party were thunderstruck, unable to draw an arrow or even to move. It stared at the hunting party. Its normally green eyes went yellow, and it fluttered its wings. There was no danger that it could fly away from them. Its wings would not be well developed enough to support it in the air for at least another 50 years and 2 more moultings, but the baby webbing which holds the wings against a dragon's body until its 10th or 12th year had fallen away, and a single flutter stirred enough wind to topple the head huntsman backward out of his saddle, his horn flying from his hand. Roland was the only one not stunned to utter movelessness, and although he was too modest to say so to Sasha, there was real heroism in his next few actions, as well as a sportsman's zest for the kill. The dragon might well have roasted most of the surprised party alive, if not for Roland's prompt action. He gigged his horse forward 5 steps and knocked his great arrow. He drew and fired. The arrow went straight to the mark, that one gill-like soft spot under the dragon's throat where it takes in air to create fire. The worm fell dead with a final fiery gust, which set all the bushes around it alight. The squires put this out quickly, some with water, some with beer, and not a few with piss. And now that I think of it, most of the piss was really beer, because when Roland went a-hunting, he took a great lot of beer with him, and he was not stingy with it either. The fire was out in 5 minutes. The dragon gutted in 15. You still could have boiled a kettle over its steaming nostrils when its stripes were let out upon the ground. The dripping 9-chambered heart was carried to Roland with great ceremony. He ate it raw, as was the custom, and found it delicious. He only regretted the sad knowledge that he would almost certainly never have another. Perhaps it was the dragon's heart that made him so strong that night. Perhaps it was only his joy in the hunt, and in knowing he had acted quickly and cool-headedly when the others were sitting stunned in their saddles, except, of course, for the head huntsman who had been lying stunned on his back. For whatever reason, when Sasha clapped her hands and cried, "Well done, my brave husband," he fairly leaped into her bed. Sasha greeted him with open eyes and a smile that reflected his own triumph. That night was the first and only time Roland enjoyed his wife's embrace in sobriety. 9 months later, 1 month for each chamber of the dragon's heart, Peter was born in that same bed, and the kingdom rejoiced, and there was an heir to the throne. Five. You probably think, if you have bothered to think about it at all, that Roland must have stopped taking Flagg's strange green drink after the birth of Peter. Not so. He still took it occasionally. This was because he loved Sasha and wanted to please her. In some places, people assume that only men enjoy sex and that a woman would be grateful to be left alone. The people of Delane, however, held no such peculiar ideas. They assumed that a woman took normal pleasure in that act which produced Earth's most pleasurable creatures. Roland knew he was not properly attentive to his wife in this matter, but he resolved to be as attentive as he could, even if this meant taking Flagg's drink. Only Flagg himself knew how rarely the king went to his queen's bed. Some 4 years after the birth of Peter, on New Year's Day, a great blizzard visited Delane. It was the greatest, save one, in living memory. The other I'll tell you of later. Heeding an impulse he could not explain even to himself, Flagg mixed the king a draught of double strength. Perhaps it was something in the wind that urged him to do it. Ordinarily, Roland would have made a grimace at the awful taste and perhaps put it aside. But the excitement of the storm had caused the annual New Year's Day party to be especially gay, and Roland had become very drunk. The blazing fire on the hearth reminded him of the dragon's final explosive breath, and he had toasted the head, which was mounted on the wall, many times. So he drank the green potion off at a single gulp, and an evil lust fell upon him. He left the dining hall at once and visited Sasha. In the course of trying to love her, he hurt her.
"Please, husband," she cried, sobbing.
"I'm sorry," he mumbled. He fell heavily asleep beside her and remained insensible for the next 20 hours. She never forgot the strange smell that had been on his breath that night. It had been a smell like rotten meat, a smell like death. Whatever, she wondered, had he been eating or drinking? Roland never touched Flagg's drink again, but Flagg was well satisfied nevertheless. 9 months later, Sasha gave birth to Thomas, her second son. She died bringing him forth. Such things happened, of course, and while everyone was saddened, no one was really surprised. They believed they knew what had happened. But the only people in the kingdom who really knew the circumstances of Sasha's death were Anna Crookbrows, the midwife, and Flag, the king's magician. Flag's patience with Sasha's meddling had finally run out. 6. Peter was only 5 when his mother died, but he remembered her dearly. He thought her sweet, tender, loving, full of mercy. But 5 is a young age, and most of his memories were not very specific. There was one clear memory which he held in his mind, however. It was of a reproach she had made to him. Much later, the memory of this reproach became vital to him. It had to do with his napkin. Every 1st of 5 months, a feast was held at court to celebrate the spring plantings. In his 5th year, Peter was allowed to attend for the first time. Custom decreed that Roland should sit at the head of the table, the heir to the throne at his right hand, the queen at the foot of the table. The practical result of this was that Peter would be out of her reach during the meal, and so Sasha coached him carefully beforehand on how he should behave. She wanted him to show up well and to be mannerly. And, of course, she knew that during the meal he would be on his own because his father had no idea of manners at all. Some of you may wonder why the task of instructing Peter on his manners fell to Sasha. Did the boy not have a governess? Yes, as a matter of fact, he had 2. Were there no servants whose service was dedicated wholly to the little prince? Battalions of them. The trick was not to get these people to take care of Peter, but to keep them away. Sasha wanted to raise him herself, at least as much as she could. She had very definite ideas about how her son should be raised. She loved him dearly and wanted to be with him for her own selfish reasons, but she also realized that she had a deep and solemn responsibility in the matter of Peter's nurture. This little boy would be king some day, and above all else, Sasha wanted him to be good. A good boy, she thought, would be a good king. Great banquets in the king's hall were not very neat affairs, and most nannies wouldn't have been very concerned about the little boy's table manners. "Why, he is to be the king," they would have said, a little shocked at the idea that they should correct him in such piddling manners. Who cares if he spills the gravy boat? Who cares if he dribbles on his ruff or even wipes his hands on it? Did not King Alan in the old days sometimes vomit into his plate and then command his court jester to come nigh and drink this nice hot soup? Did not King John often bite the heads off live trout and then put the flopping bodies into the bodices of the serving girls' dresses? Will not this banquet end up, as most banquets do, with the participants throwing food across the table at each other? Undoubtedly it would. But by the time things degenerated to the food-throwing stage, she and Peter would long since have retired. What concerned Sasha was that attitude of who cares. She thought it was the worst idea anyone could ever plant in the head of a little boy destined to be king. So Sasha instructed Peter carefully, and she observed him carefully on the night of the banquet, and later, as he lay sleepy in his bed, she talked to him. Because she was a good mother, she first complimented him lovingly on his behavior and manners, and this was right, because for the most part they had been exemplary. But she knew that no one would correct him where he went wrong unless she did it herself, and she knew she must do it now in these few years when he idolized her. So when she was finished complimenting him, she said, "You did one thing wrong, Pete, and I never want to see you do it again." Peter lay in his bed, his dark blue eyes looking at her solemnly. "What was that, Mother?" "You didn't use your napkin," said she. "You left it folded by your plate, and it made me sorry to see it. You ate the roast chicken with your fingers, and that was fine, because that is how men do it. But when you put the chicken down again, you wiped your fingers on your shirt, and that is not right."
"But Father and Mr. Flag and the other nobles—"
"Bother Flag and bother all the nobles in Delane," she cried with such force that Peter cringed back in his bed a little. He was afraid and ashamed for having made those roses bloom in her cheeks.
"What your father does is right, for he is the king, and what you do when you are king will always be right. But Flag is not king, no matter how much he would like to be, and the nobles are not kings, and you are not king yet, but only a little boy who forgot his manners."
She saw he was afraid and smiled. She laid her hand on his brow.
"Be calm, Peter," she said. "It is a small thing, but still important, because you'll be king in your own time. Now run and fetch your slate." "But it's bedtime," bother bedtime, too. Bedtime can wait. Bring your slate. Peter ran for his slate. Sasha took the chalk tied to the side and carefully printed three letters. Can you read this word, Peter?
Peter nodded. There were only a few words that he could read, although he knew most of the great letters. This happened to be one of the words.
It says, God.
Yes, that's right. Now write it backward and see what you find.
Backward?
Peter said doubtfully.
Yes, that's right.
Peter did so, his letters staggering childishly across the slate below his mother's neat printing. He was astounded to find another of the few words he could read.
Dog. Mama, it says dog.
Yes, it says dog. The sadness in her voice quenched Peter's excitement at once. His mother pointed from God to dog.
There are two natures of man, she said. Never forget them, because some day you will be king, and kings grow to be great and tall, as great and tall as dragons in their ninth moultings.
Father is great and tall, objected Peter. Roland was, in fact, short and rather bow-legged. Also, he carried a great belly in front of him from all the beer and mead he had consumed.
Sasha smiled. He is, though. Kings grow invisibly, Peter, and it happens all at once, as soon as they grasp the scepter and the crown is put on their heads in the Plaza of the Needle.
They do? Peter's eyes grew large and round. He thought that the subject had wandered far from his failure to use his napkin at the banquet, but he was not sorry to see such an embarrassing topic lost in favor of this tremendously interesting one. Besides, he had already resolved that he would never forget to use his napkin again. If it was important to his mother, then it was important to him.
Oh, yes, they do. Kings grow most awfully big, and that's why they have to be specially careful, for a very big person could crush smaller ones under his feet just taking a walk, or turning around, or sitting down quickly in the wrong place. Bad kings do such things often. I think even good kings cannot avoid doing them sometimes.
I don't think I understand.
Then listen a moment longer.
She tapped the slate again.
Our preachers say that our natures are partly of God and partly of
Old Man Splitfoot.
Do you know who Old Man Splitfoot is, Peter?
He's the devil.
Yes, but there are few devils outside of made-up stories, Pete. Most bad people are more like dogs than devils. Dogs are friendly but stupid, and that's the way most men and women are when they are drunk. When dogs are excited and confused, they may bite. When men are excited and confused, they may fight. Dogs are great pets because they are loyal, but if a pet is all a man is, he is a bad man, I think. Dogs can be brave, but they may also be cowards that will howl in the dark or run away from danger with their tails between their legs. A dog is just as eager to lick the hand of a bad master as he is to lick the hand of a good one, because dogs don't know the difference between good and bad. A dog will eat slops, vomit up the part his stomach can't stand, and then go back for more. She fell silent for a moment, perhaps thinking of what was going on in the banqueting hall right now. Men and women roaring with good-natured, drunken laughter, flinging food at each other and sometimes turning aside to vomit casually on the floor beside their chairs. Roland was much the same, and sometimes this made her sad, but she did not hold it against him, nor did she tax him with it. It was his way. He might promise to reform in order to please her, and he might even do it, but he would not be the same man afterward. Do you understand these things, Peter?
Peter nodded.
Fine. Now tell me.
She leaned toward him.
Does a dog use a napkin?
Humbled and ashamed, Peter looked down at the counterpane and shook his head. Apparently, the conversation hadn't wandered as far as he had thought. Perhaps because the evening had been very full and because he was now very tired, tears rose in his eyes and spilled down his cheeks. He struggled against the sobs that wanted to come. He locked them in his chest. Sasha saw this and admired it.
Don't cry over an unused napkin, my love, said Sasha, for that was not my intention.
She rose, her full and pregnant belly before her. The delivery of Thomas was now very near.
Your behavior was otherwise exemplary. Any mother in the kingdom would have been proud of a young son who behaved himself half so well, and my heart is full with admiration for you. I only tell you these things because I am the mother of a prince. That is sometimes hard, but it cannot be changed. And in truth, I would not change it if I could. But remember that some day lives will depend on your every waking motion. Lives may even depend on dreams which come to you in sleep. Lives may not depend on whether or not you use your napkin after the roast chicken. But they may. They may. Lives have depended on less, at times. All I ask is that in everything you do, you try to remember the civilized side of your nature, the good side, the God side. Will you promise to do that, Peter?
I promise.
Then all is well. She kissed him lightly. Luckily, I am young and you are young. We will talk of these things more when you have more understanding.
They never did. But Peter never forgot the lesson. He always used his napkin, even when those around him did not.
Seven. So, Sasha died. She has little more part in this story, yet there is one further thing about her you should know. She had a dollhouse. This dollhouse was very large and very fine, almost a castle in miniature. When the time of her marriage came round, Sasha mustered as much cheer as she could, but she was sad to be leaving everyone and everything at the great house in the western barony where she had grown up, and she was a little bit nervous, too. She told her mother, "I have never been married before and do not know if I shall like it." But of all the childish things she left behind, the one she regretted most was the dollhouse she had had ever since she was a little girl. Roland, who was a kind man, somehow discovered this, and although he was also nervous about his future life, after all, he had never been married before either, he found time to commission Quentin Ellender, the greatest craftsman in the land, to build his new wife a new dollhouse. "I want it to be the finest dollhouse a young lady ever had," he told Ellender. "I want her to look at it once and forget about her old dollhouse forever." As you'll no doubt realize, if Roland really meant this, it was a foolish thing to say. No one ever forgets a toy that made him or her supremely happy as a child, even if that toy is replaced by one like it that is much nicer. Sasha never forgot her old dollhouse, but she was quite impressed with the new one. Anyone who was not a total idiot would have been. Those who saw it declared it was Quentin Ellender's best work, and it may have been. It was a country house in miniature, very like the one Sasha had lived in with her parents in rolling western barony. Everything in it was small, but so cunningly made you would swear it must really work, and most things in it did. The stove, for instance, really got hot and would even cook tiny portions of food. If you put a piece of hard coal no bigger than a matchbox in it, it would burn all day. And if you reached into the kitchen with your clumsy big person's finger and happened to touch the stove while the coal was burning, it would give you a burn for your pains. There were no faucets and no flushing toilets, because the kingdom of Delane did not know about such things, and doesn't even to this day. But if you were very careful, you could pump water from a hand pump that stood not much taller than your pinky finger. There was a sewing room with a spinning wheel that really spun and a loom that really wove. The spinet in the parlor would really play, if you touched the keys with a toothpick, and the tone was true. People who saw this said it was a miracle, and surely Flagg must have been involved somehow. When Flagg heard such stories, he only smiled and said nothing. He had not been involved in the dollhouse at all. He thought it a silly project, in truth. But he also knew it was not always necessary to make claims and tell people how wonderful you were to achieve greatness. Sometimes all you had to do was look wise and keep your mouth shut. In Sasha's dollhouse were real Cachemin rugs, real velvet curtains, real china plates. The cold cabinet really kept things cold. The wainscoting in the receiving parlor in the front hall was of cherished ironwood. There was glass in all the windows and a many-colored fanlight over the wide front doors. All in all, it was the jolliest dollhouse any child ever dreamed of. Sasha clapped her hands over it with real delight at the wedding party when it was unveiled and thanked her husband for it. Later she went to Ellender's workshop and not only thanked him, but curtsied deeply before him, an act that was almost unheard of. In that day and age, queens did not curtsy to mere artisans. Roland was pleased, and Ellender, whose sight had failed noticeably in the course of the project, was deeply touched. But it did not make her forget her old dear dollhouse at home, as ordinary as it seemed when compared with this one, and she did not spend as many rainy afternoons playing with it, rearranging the furniture, lighting the stove, and watching the chimneys smoke, pretending that there was a high tea going on or that there was to be a great dinner party for the queen.
as she had before, even as an older girl of 15 and 16. One of the reasons was very simple. There was no fun making ready for a pretend party at which the queen would be in attendance when she was the queen, and maybe that one reason was really all the reasons. She was a grown-up now, and she discovered that being a grown-up was not quite what she had suspected it would be when she was a child. She had thought then that she would make a conscious decision one day to simply put her toys and games and little make-believes away. Now she discovered that was not what happened at all. Instead, she discovered, interest simply faded. It became less and less and less, until a dust of years drew over the bright pleasures of childhood and they were forgotten.
Eight. Peter, a little boy who would someday be king, had dozens of toys. Now, if I am to tell you the truth, he had thousands of toys. He had hundreds of lead soldiers with which he fought great battles and dozens of play horses. He had games and balls and jacks and marbles. He had stilts that made him 5 feet high. He had a magical spring stick on which he could bounce, and all the drawing paper he wanted, in a time when paper was extremely hard to make, and only wealthy people could afford to have it. But of all the toys in the castle, the one he loved the best was his mother's dollhouse. He had never known the one in Western Barony, and so to him, this was the dollhouse of dollhouses. He would sit before it for hours on end when the rain poured down outside, or when the winter wind shrieked out of a blue throat filled with snow, when he fell ill with children's tattoo, a disease which we call chickenpox. He had a servant bring it to him on a special table that went over his bed and played with it almost ceaselessly until he was well. He loved to imagine the tiny people that would fill the house. Sometimes they were almost so real he could see them. He talked for them in different voices and invented them all. They were the King family. There was Roger King, who was brave and powerful, if not very tall and slightly bow-legged, and who had once killed a dragon. There was lovely Sarah King, his wife, and there was their little boy, Petey, who loved and was loved by them. Not to mention, of course, all the servants he invented to make the beds, stoke the stove, fetch the water, cook the meals, and mend the clothes. Because he was a boy, some of the stories he made up to go with the house were a little more bloodthirsty than the stories Sasha had made up to go with hers as a little girl. In one of them, the Anduin pirates were all around the house, wanting to get in and slaughter the family. There was a famous fight. Dozens of pirates were killed, but in the end they were too many. They made to attack for the final time, but just before they did, the king's own guard, this part was played by Peter's lead soldiers, arrived and killed every one of those rotten Anduin sea dogs. In another story, a nest of dragons burst out of a nearby wood, usually the nearby wood was under Sasha's sofa by the window, meaning to burn up the house with their furious breath. But Roger and Petey rushed out with their bows and killed every one, until the ground was black with their icky old blood, Peter told his father, the king, that night at dinner, and this made Roland roar with approval. After Sasha died, Flag told Roland that he did not believe it was right for a boy to be playing with dollhouses. It might not make him a sissy, Flag said, but then again, it might. Certainly it would not sound well if the tale got out to the general population, and such stories always did. The castle was full of servants. Servants saw everything, and their tongues wagged. "He's only 6, Roland said, uneasy. Flag, with his white, hungry face far back in his deep hood at his magical spells, always made him uneasy.
6 is old enough to train a boy in the way he should go, sire, Flag said. Think you well on it. Your judgment will be right in this, as in all things.
Think you well on it, Flag said, and that was just what King Roland did. In fact, I should think it fair to say that he never thought on anything so hard during his entire 20-some-year reign as King of Delane. That probably sounds strange to you, if you have thought of all the duties a king has, weighty matters such as putting taxes on some things or ending them on others, whether or not to declare war, whether to pardon or condemn, what, you might say,
was a decision over whether or not to allow a little boy to play with a dollhouse next to those other things. Maybe nothing. Maybe much. I will let you make up your mind on that. I will tell you that Roland was not the smartest king who had ever ruled in Delane. Thinking well had always been very hard work for him. It made him feel as if boulders were rolling around in his head. It made his eyes water and his temples throb. When he thought deeply, his nose got stuffed up. As a boy, his studies in composition and mathematics and history had made his head ache so badly that he had been allowed to give them up at 12 and do what he did best, which was to hunt. He tried very hard to be a good king, but he had a feeling that he could never be good enough or smart enough to solve the kingdom's problems or to make many decisions the right way, and he knew if he made them the wrong way, people would suffer for it. If he had heard Sasha telling Peter about kings after the banquet, he would have agreed completely. Kings really were bigger than other people, and sometimes, a lot of times, he wished he were smaller. If you have ever in your life had serious questions about whether or not you were good enough for some task, then you will know how he felt. What you may not know is that such worries start to feed on themselves after a while. Even if that feeling that you aren't good enough to get the job done isn't true at first, it can become true in time. This had happened to Roland, and over the years, he had come to rely more and more on Flag. He was sometimes troubled by the idea that Flag was king in all but name, but these worries came only late at night. In the daytime, he was only grateful for Flag's support. If not for Sasha, Roland might have been a much worse king than he really was, and that was because the little voice he sometimes heard in the night when he couldn't sleep held much more of the truth than his daytime gratitudes. Flag really was running the kingdom, and Flag was a very bad man. We will have to speak more of him later, unfortunately, but we'll let him go for now, and good riddance. Sasha had broken Flag's power over Roland a little. Her own advice was good and practical, and it was much more kind and just than the magician's. She never really liked Flag, few in Delane did, and many shuddered at his very name. But her dislike was mild. Her feelings might have been much different if she had known how carefully Flag watched her, and with what growing, poisonous hate. Nine. Once Flag really did set out to poison Sasha, this was after she asked Roland to pardon a pair of army deserters whom Flag had wanted beheaded in the Plaza of the Needle. Deserters, he had argued, were a bad example. If one or two were allowed to get away without paying the full penalty, others might try it. The only way to discourage them, he said, was to show them the heads of those who had already tried it. Other would-be deserters would look at those fly-blown heads with their staring eyes and think twice about the seriousness of their service to the king. Sasha, however, had discovered facts about the case from one of her maids that Roland didn't know. The mother of the older boy had fallen gravely ill. There were three younger brothers and two younger sisters in the family. All might have died in the bitter cold of the Delane winter if the boy hadn't left his encampment, gone home, and chopped wood for his mother. The younger boy had gone because he was the older's best friend and his sworn blood brother. Without the younger boy, it might have taken 2 weeks to chop enough wood to keep the family through the winter. With both of them working at top speed, it had taken only 6 days. This was putting it in a different light. Roland had loved his own mother very much and would gladly have died for her. He made inquiries and found out that Sasha had the right of the story. He also found out that the deserters had left only after a sadistic sergeant major had repeatedly refused to relay their requests for compassionate leave to their superior, and that as soon as 4 cords of wood had been chopped, they had gone back, although both had known they must be court-martialed and face the headsman's axe. Roland pardoned them. Flag nodded, smiled, and said only,
"Your will is Delane's will, sire."
Not for all the gold in the 4 kingdoms would he have allowed Roland to see the sick fury that rose in his heart when his will was balked. Roland's pardon of the boys was greatly praised in Delane, because many of Roland's subjects also knew the true facts, and those who didn't know them were quickly informed by the rest. Roland's wise and compassionate pardon of the two was remembered when other, less humane decrees, which were, as a rule, also the magician's ideas, were imposed. All of this made no difference to Flag. He had wanted them killed, and Sasha had interfered. Why could Roland not have married another? He had known none of them and cared for women not at all. Why not another? Well, it didn't matter. Flagg smiled at the pardon, but he swore in his heart then that he would attend Sasha's funeral. On the night Roland signed the pardon, Flagg went to his gloomy basement laboratory. There he donned a heavy glove and took a death-watch spider from a cage where he had kept her for 20 years, feeding her newborn baby mice. Each of the mice he fed the spider was poisoned and dying. Flagg did this to increase the potency of the spider's own poison, which was already potent beyond belief. The spider was blood-red and as big as a rat. Her bloated body quivered with venom. Venom dripped from her stinger in clear drops that burned smoking holes in the top of Flagg's work table.
"Now die, my pretty, and kill a queen,"
Flagg whispered, and crushed the spider to death in his glove, which was made of a magical steel mesh which resisted the poison. Yet still that night, when he went to bed, his hand was swelled and throbbing and red. Poison from the spider's crushed, twisted body gushed into the goblet. Flagg poured brandy over the deadly stuff, then stirred the two together. When he took the spoon from the glass, its bowl was twisted and misshapen. The queen would take one sip and fall dying on the floor. Her death would be quick, but extremely painful, Flagg thought with satisfaction. Sasha was in the habit of taking a glass of brandy each night because she often had trouble falling asleep. Flagg rang for a servant to come and take the drink to her. Sasha never knew how close she came to death that night. Moments after brewing the deadly drink, before the servant knocked, Flagg poured it down the drain in the center of his floor and stood listening to it hiss and bubble away into the pipe. His face was twisted with hate. When the hissing had died away, he flung the crystal goblet into the far corner with all his force. It shattered like a bomb. The servant knocked and was admitted. Flagg pointed to where the shards glittered.
"I've broken a goblet," he said. "Clean it up. Use a broom, idiot. If you touch the pieces, you'll regret it."
Ten. He poured the poison down the drain at the last moment because he realized he might well be caught. If Roland had loved the young queen just a little less, Flagg would have chanced it. But he was afraid that Roland, in his wounded fury at the loss of his wife, would never rest until he found the killer and saw his head on the spike at the very tip of the needle. It was the one crime he would see avenged, no matter who had committed it. And would he find the murderer? Flagg thought he might. Hunting, after all, was the thing Roland did best. So Sasha escaped. That time. Protected by Flagg's fear and her husband's love. And in the meantime, Flagg still had the king's ear in most matters. Concerning the dollhouse, however, in that matter you could say Sasha won, even though Flagg had by then succeeded in ridding himself of her. 11. Not long after Flagg made his disparaging comments about dollhouses and royal sissies, Roland crept into the dead queen's morning room unseen and watched his son at play. The king stood just inside the door, his brow deeply furrowed. He was thinking much harder than he was used to thinking, and that meant the boulders were rolling around in his head and his nose was stuffy. He saw that Peter was using the dollhouse to tell himself stories, to make believe, and that the stories he made up were not sissy stories at all. They were stories of blood and thunder and armies and dragons. They were, in other words, stories after the king's own heart. He discovered in himself a wistful desire to join his son, to help him make up even better tales in which the dollhouse and all its fascinating contents and its make-believe family figured. Most of all, he saw that Peter was using Sasha's dollhouse to keep Sasha alive in his heart, and Roland approved of this most of all because he missed his wife sorely. Sometimes he was so lonely he almost cried. Kings, of course, do not cry. And if, on one or two occasions after Sasha had died, he awoke with the case on his pillow damp, what of that? The king left the room as silently as he had come. Peter never saw him. Roland lay awake most of that night, thinking deeply about what he had seen, and although it was hard for him to endure Flagg's disapproval, he saw him the next morning in a private audience, before his resolve could weaken, and told him he had thought the matter over carefully, and decided Peter should be allowed to play with the dollhouse as long as he wished. He said he believed it was doing the boy no harm. With that out, he settled back uneasily to wait for Flagg's rebuttal, but no rebuttal came. Flagg only raised his eyebrows, this Roland barely saw in the deep shadow of the hood Flagg always wore, and said,
"Your will, sire, is the will of the kingdom."
Roland knew from the tone that Flagg thought his decision was a bad one, but the tone also told him Flagg would not dispute it further. He was deeply relieved to be let off so cheaply. Later that day, when Flagg suggested that the farmers of the eastern barony could stand higher taxes, in spite of the drought that had killed most of their crops the year before, Roland agreed eagerly. In truth, having the old fool, for so Flagg thought Roland to be in his deeper thoughts, go against his wishes in the matter of the dollhouse seemed a very minor thing to the magician. The rise in taxes for the eastern barony was the important thing, and Flagg had a deeper secret, one which pleased him well. In the end, he had succeeded in murdering Sasha after all. 12. In those days, when a queen or any woman of royal birth was taken to bed to deliver a child, a midwife was called in. The doctors were all men, and no man was allowed to be with a woman when she was about to have a child. The midwife who delivered Peter was Anna Crookbrows of the 3rd Southard Alley. She was called again when Sasha's time with Thomas came around. Anna was past 50 at the time when Sasha's second labor began, and a widow. She had one son of her own, and in his 20th year he contracted the shaking disease, which always killed its victims in terrible pain after some years of suffering. She loved this boy very much, and at last, after every other idea had proved useless, she went to Flagg. This had been 10 years before, neither prince yet born, and Roland himself still a royal bachelor. He received her in his dank basement rooms, which were near the dungeons. During their interview, the uneasy woman could sometimes hear the lost screams of those who had been locked away from the sun's light for years and years. And, she thought with a shudder, if the dungeons were near, then the torture chambers must also be near. Nor did Flagg's apartment itself make her feel any easier. Strange designs were drawn on the floor in many colors of chalk. When she blinked, the designs seemed to change. In a cage hung from a long black manacle, a two-headed parrot cawed and sometimes talked to itself, one head speaking, the other head answering. Musty books frowned down at her. Spiders spun in dark corners. From the laboratory came a mixture of strange chemical smells, yet she stammered out her story somehow and then waited in an agony of suspense.
"I can cure your son,"
he said finally. Anna Crookbrow's ugly face was transformed into something near beauty by her joy.
"My lord!"
she gasped and could think of no more, so she said it again.
"Oh, my lord!"
But in the shadow of his hood, Flagg's white face remained distant and brooding, and she felt afraid again.
"What would you pay for such a miracle?"
he asked.
"Anything!"
she gasped, and meant it.
"Oh, my lord Flagg, anything!"
"I ask for one favor,"
he said.
"Will you give it?"
"Gladly."
"I don't know what it is yet, but when the time comes, I shall."
She had fallen on her knees before him, and now he bent toward her. His hood fell back, and his face was terrible indeed. It was the white face of a corpse with black holes for eyes.
"And if you refuse what I ask, woman?"
"I shall not refuse, oh my lord, I shall not, I swear it on my dear husband's name."
"Then it is well. Bring your son to me tomorrow night, after dark."
She led the poor boy in the next night. He trembled and shook. His head nodded foolishly. His eyes rolled. There was a slick of drool on his chin. Flag gave her a dark, plum-colored potion in a beaker.
"Have him drink this,"
he said.
"It will blister his mouth, but have him drink every drop. Then get the fool out of my sight."
She murmured to him. The boy's shaking increased for a moment as he tried to nod his head. He drank all of the liquid and then doubled over, screaming.
"Get him out,"
Flag said.
"Yes, get him out,"
one of the parrot's two heads cried.
"Get him out! No screaming allowed here,"
the other head screamed. She got him home, sure that Flag had murdered him. But the next day, the shaking disease had left her son completely and he was well. Years passed. When Sasha's labor with Thomas began, Flag called for her and whispered in her ear. They were alone in his deep rooms, but even so, it was better that such a dread command be whispered. Anna Crookbrow's face went deadly white, but she remembered Flag's words, "If you refuse." And would not the king have two children? She had only one. And if the king wanted to remarry and have even more, let him. In Delane, women were plentiful. So she went to Sasha and spoke encouragingly, and at a critical moment a little knife glittered in her hand. No one saw the one small cut she made. A moment later Anna cried,
"Push, my queen! Push, for the baby comes!"
Sasha pushed. Thomas came from her as effortlessly as a boy zipping down a slide, but Sasha's life blood gushed out upon the sheet. 10 minutes after Thomas came into the world, his mother was dead. And so Flag was not concerned about the piffling matter of the dollhouse. What mattered was that Roland was growing old, there was no meddling queen to stand in his way, and now he had not one son to choose from, but two. Peter was, of course, the elder, but that did not really matter. Peter could be gotten out of the way if time should prove him unsuitable for Flag's purposes. He was only a child and could not defend himself. I have told you that Roland never thought longer or harder on any matter during his entire reign than he did on this one question, whether or not Peter should be allowed access to Sasha's dollhouse, cunningly crafted by the great Ellender. I have told you that the result of his thought was a decision that ran against Flag's wishes. I have also told you that Flag considered this of little importance. Was it? That you must decide for yourself, after you have heard me to the end. XIII. Now let many long years pass, all in a twinkling. One of the great things about tales is how fast time may pass when not much of note is happening. Real life is never that way, and it is probably a good thing. Time only passes faster in histories, and what is a history except a grand sort of tale where passing centuries are substituted for passing years? During those years, Flag watched both boys carefully. He watched them over the aging king's shoulder as they grew up, calculating which should be king when Roland was no more. It did not take him long to decide it should be Thomas, the younger. By the time Peter was 7, he knew he did not like the boy. When Peter was 9, Flag made a strange and unpleasant discovery. He feared Peter as well. The boy had grown up strong and straight and handsome. His hair was dark, his eyes a dark blue that is common to people of the Western Barony. Sometimes, when Peter looked up quickly, his head cocked a certain way. He resembled his father. Otherwise, he was Sasha's son, almost entirely in his looks and ways. Unlike his short father with his bow-legged walk and his clumsy way of moving, Roland was graceful only when he was horsed, Peter was tall and lithe. He enjoyed the hunt and hunted well, but it was not his life. He also enjoyed his lessons. Geography and history were his particular favorites. His father was puzzled and often impatient with jokes. The point of most had to be explained to him, and that took away all the fun. What Roland liked was when the jesters pretended to slip on banana peels or knocked their heads together or when they staged pie fights in the Great Hall. Such things were about as far as Roland's idea of good fun extended. Peter's wit was much quicker and more subtle, as Sasha's had been, and his rollicking boyish laughter often filled the palace, making the servants smile at each other approvingly. While many boys in Peter's position would have become too conscious of their own grand place in the scheme of things to play with anyone not of their own class, Peter became best friends with a boy named Ben Stad when both children were 8. Ben's family was not royalty, and though Andrew Stad, Ben's father, had some faint claim to the high blood of the kingdom on his mother's side, they could not even rightly be called nobility. Squire was probably the kindest term one could have applied to Andy Stad, and Squire's son to his boy. Even so, the once prosperous Stad family had fallen upon hard times, and while there could have been queerer choices for a prince's best friend, there couldn't have been many. They met at the annual Farmer's Lawn Party when Peter was 8. The lawn party was a yearly ritual most kings and queens viewed as tiresome at best. They were apt to put in a token appearance, drink the quick traditional toast, and then be away after bidding the farmers enjoy themselves and thanking them for another fruitful year. This was also part of the ritual, even if the crops had been poor. If Roland had been that sort of king, Peter and Ben would never have gotten the chance to know each other. But, as you might have guessed, Roland loved the farmer's lawn party, looked forward to it each year, and usually stayed until the very end, and more than once was carried away drunk and snoring loudly. As it happened, Peter and Ben were paired in the three-legged sack race, and they won it, although it ended up being much closer than at first it seemed it would be. Leading by almost 6 lengths, they took a bad spill and Peter's arm was cut.
"I'm sorry, my prince,"
Ben cried. His face had gone pale, and he may have been visualizing the dungeons. And I know his mother and father, watching anxiously from the sidelines, were. If it weren't for bad luck, Andy Stad was fond of growling, the Stads would have no luck at all. More likely he was just sorry for the hurt he fancied he had caused, or was amazed to see that the blood of the future king was as red as his own.
"Don't be a fool," Peter said impatiently. "It was my fault, not yours. I was clumsy. Hurry and get up. They're catching us."
The two boys, made into a single clumsy three-legged beast by the sack into which Peter's left leg and Ben's right one had been tightly tied, managed to get up and lurch on. Both had been badly winded by the fall, however, and their long lead had been cut to almost nothing. Approaching the finish line, where crowds of farmers, not to mention Roland, standing among them without the slightest feeling of awkwardness or of being somewhere he shouldn't, were cheering deliriously, two huge, sweating farm boys began to close in. That they would overtake Peter and Ben in the last 10 yards of the race seemed almost inevitable.
"Faster, Peter!"
Roland bellowed, swinging a huge mug of mead with such enthusiasm that he poured most of it onto his own head. In his excitement, he never noticed.
"Jackrabbit, son! Be a jackrabbit! Those clodbusters are almost up your butt and over your back!"
Ben's mother began to moan, cursing the fate that had caused her son to be paired up with the prince.
"If they lose, he'll have our Ben thrown into the deepest dungeon in the castle," she moaned.
"Hush, woman," Andy said. "He'd not. He's a good king."
He believed it, but he was still afraid. Stad luck was, after all, Stad luck. Ben, meanwhile, had begun to giggle. He couldn't believe he was doing it, but he was.
"Be a jackrabbit, did he say?"
Peter also began to giggle. His legs ached terribly. Blood was trickling down his right arm, and sweat was flooding his face, which was starting to turn an interesting plum color, but he was also unable to stop.
"Yes, that's what he said. Then let's hop."
They didn't look much like jackrabbits as they crossed the finish line. They looked like a pair of strange, crippled crows. It was really a miracle they didn't fall, but somehow they didn't. They managed 3 ungainly leaps. The third one took them across the finish line, where they collapsed, howling with laughter.
"Jackrabbit!"
Ben yelled, pointing at Peter.
"Jackrabbit yourself!"
Peter yelled, pointing back. They slung their arms about each other, still laughing, and were carried on the shoulders of many strong farmers. Andrew Stad was one of them, and bearing the combined weight of his son and the prince was something he never forgot. To where Roland slipped blue ribbons over their necks, then he kissed each of them roughly on the cheek and poured the remaining contents of his mug over their heads to the wild cheers and huzzas of the farmers. Never, even in the memory of the oldest gaffer there that day, had such an extraordinary race been run. The two boys spent the rest of the day together and, it soon appeared, would be content to spend the rest of their lives together. Because even a boy of 8 has certain duties,
and if he is to be the king some day, he has even more. The two of them could not be together all they wanted to be, but when they could be, they were. Some sniffed at the friendship and said it wasn't right for the king in waiting to be friends with a boy who was little better than a common barony clodbuster. Most, however, looked upon it with approval.